Robbie Buck and Wendy Harmer on ABC Radio Sydney.
Guess who we have on the phone line?
Yeah, we have the wonderful Michael Palin with us. Michael Palin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you and good morning.
Good morning.
Yes,
good morning to you. Gosh, Michael, I must say not only have you had this trailblazing career in comedy, but then to reinvent yourself into a travel documentary maker, that was one of the smartest things that you ever did, don't you think?
Yeah, I didn't think of it at the time. I just thought this was a great opportunity. Someone said, do you want to go around the world in 80 days and the BBC will pay and we'll film you doing it and all that. And I thought, what's not to like? And then a couple of days before, I began to get the wobblies and the butterflies. I thought, there's no script, we're just going to go around and point the camera and I have no expertise in these things. What am I going to say? How am I going to kind of survive? I don't speak the languages. So suddenly all the negatives came up. But in the end, it worked out well. I just ended up being myself rather than trying to be someone I wasn't. And I think that was the key thing.
And the places that you've been, I'm just looking at this list here, the North Pole, South Pole, Sahara Desert, the jungle of the Amazon, the Himalayas, and you've even been the president of the British Geographical Society for a few years. We have to know what you've still got on your list, Michael.
I don't have a list as such. I did some long journeys for the BBC. We were away for some 6 months, 7 months, a long time. I think I'm now 75. I quite like being at home a bit more. I've got my grandchildren growing up, so I do shorter journeys. But there's still lots of places that I want to see, and other places I've been to that I'd like to go to again. So I'm ever curious.
I
never know what's going to come up next.
Michael, what are your favourite things to do at home? You mentioned that you like to be a bit of a homebody. What's your great pursuits at home?
Well, most of all, I suppose it's sort of keeping in touch with the family. You've got four grandchildren now, so I go and spend some time with them. Being at home is sort of, I keep quite fit at home. We're on the edge of Hampstead Heath, which is a lovely open area of North London, and I try and run there a couple of times a week. We go out less than we used to, but we try and catch a show or a movie. Or otherwise, I just sit at home and drink. It's very sad.
You're not alone.
Now, tell us about the show that you're bringing to Australia, Michael.
Yeah, well, it's a two-part show. Mm-hmm. Part of it is really to introduce my new book, which is coming out in September, which is called Erebus, The Story of a Ship. And this is a kind of reinvention for me because I'm sort of like a naval historian, but it's a wonderful story. Erebus went to the Antarctic in 1839 under sail, no motors or anything like that, went further south than any other ship had ever been. It got in the ice, it was nearly crushed by icebergs. They got safely back home 4 years later. Erebus was then chosen as a flagship for an expedition to go through the Northwest Passage from the Atlantic to the Pacific, and that was the greatest disaster in British naval exploration. Both ships and all the men were lost. So I thought this is a remarkable ship. How did it do all this? It wasn't a big ship. So I did some research, and I was boosted by the fact that 4 years ago, the Canadian government found the hull of HMS Erebus under the waters of the Canadian Arctic. It had been there about 170 years, was reasonably well preserved because of the cold. So it's a great story. Mm.
It certainly puts our own travels, and I guess yours, even if they're 6 or 7 months, into a bit of context as well. What are your reflections on how we travel in the modern age compared to what it was like 100 years ago?
Well, I don't think we really have a concept of the unknown anymore. No. The world is mapped, especially now with GPS. You can pretty much find anyone anywhere on Earth. At that time, in the 1840s, no one even knew whether Antarctica existed. Was it just sort of a few islands with snow and ice on them? Erebus was the first really to confirm that there was an Antarctic continent. So these guys were sailing into the unknown where there were no maps, no charts. You just had to learn a bit day by day and decide how far you could go before coming back home to safety. And they took huge risks, which I don't think we would do nowadays because we have so much more information about the world and where we're going and where things are.
But I wonder, Michael, if in some ways that's why we aren't so fascinated with going to Mars, because of that sense of the unknown. Do you think there's any parallels to be drawn there?
Yes, I think very, very much. I mean, there's always a side of us which says, if it's there and we know it's there, we must get to it.
Yes, indeed.
However we can. And in my lifetime, of course, it was the moon landings in 1969. Mm. And I think it was exactly the same motivation that these people had in the 1830s. We know, we've heard there's land down there. We don't quite sure what it is. But no one has seen the southern quarter of the Earth. We've got to go there and we've got to see what it's like. And I think that was really what motivated them. And also, once you've seen it, then you can understand it. And mankind has tried to sort of understand where it is and why it's there and what it's living in. And people always want to know all that.
Mm. Well, I guess we have to get to the sad part of your travels, Michael, which is how much you would see the world has changed since you first set out, and what we're losing in terms of ice cover and all that. I mean, I guess, do you feel that you have had the best of it in some ways?
In some ways, I suppose I do, because I travelled at times when, although it was difficult to get to some countries, particularly in Central Africa, now it would be impossible. There've been a lot more sort of terrorist attacks in that part of the world, which, when we were travelling at the end of the last century, there weren't quite so many of those. I've been to Antarctica and I've been to the Arctic, and there's still huge, splendid, magnificent spaces. And it's very, very hard to hear that these glaciers that you're looking at and that are so spectacular are going to be a quarter of the size in 10 years' time and maybe disappeared completely in 20 years' time. And that seems irreversible now, and that's something we'll just have to try and deal with. I don't know quite how we do, but, I'm an optimist. I always believe in the end we'll somehow work it out. But it's sad to see things disappearing and being threatened, coral reefs and all that.
Yeah, Michael Palin is with us live on the show this morning. Of course, a comedian and actor and TV presenter. Michael, on a more personal note, I sat down and watched The Life of Brian with my two children. They were watching it for the first time just a few weeks ago, and we sat there and laughed and laughed, and I was thinking about just the rich comedy that you have been a part of for so many years. And we had a text this morning from Christine saying, a Monty Pythonite for a grandfather. How excellent. Do your grandkids, have they watched much of your material from the past? Do they revel in it?
They haven't watched a lot, actually. I think they're just, like my own children, vaguely embarrassed. I've shown them, simple things like the fish slapping dance, that they like that very much. But they say, Grandpa, what were you doing that for, And I think they're rather more adult than I was. They're only 12 years old.
I know that John Cleese talks about political correctness in comedy, that chestnut, though. I wonder whether you think that you would be able to make Life of Brian these days. What do you reckon?
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, I think you probably could have made The Life of Brian, but you certainly couldn't make The Life of Muhammad, for instance. There's just certain sensibilities that are there, and it's very, very, it would be very, very difficult. And The Life of Brian really was about religious authority, but very much seen through a sort of Western prism. And I think once you go into religious authority sort of in Muslim areas, for instance, it'd be very, very difficult. I don't think we'd be able to make the same jokes because we wouldn't understand the cultural and religious context anyway. So I think you'd have to be pretty careful where you go now. But I think the great thing about comedy is it creeps up on you unsuspectingly. I mean, something will make you laugh, and then you can't then stop and say, "I shouldn't have laughed at that." It's too late.
That's true. Quite right.
I think right back to my school days when I was one of those people in class who was always a bit of a giggler. I'm afraid, you know, I was always cracked up about something. And they would say, you know, "Hey, then stop laughing. Not stop laughing, you will come in." And, of course, as soon as they tell you to stop laughing, you're absolutely susceptible to the boy next door who's putting something under the desk saying, "Keep on laughing." So, you know, laughter is quite a subversive thing and can't be put in a box and categorised.
Oh, it's a wonderfully powerful thing too. And what about you, Michael? Do you go back and watch some of those early skits?
I don't actually watch them that often, although I do. I'm much more comfortable watching them now at a distance than I was at the time. It's like films I've done and all that. At the time I look at them and I think, "Oh, I should have done this, should have done that." But 20 years on, you just relax and you watch the whole thing. And the Python things I've seen, I've actually enjoyed a bit more and more over the years. And very recently, I gave an archive of my work to the British Library in London, and they discovered some sketches which I didn't even know I'd ever written, work I'd done with Terry Jones. And that was absolutely fascinating to revisit stuff that you'd completely forgotten about.
Well.
And some of it, I have to say, was quite funny. I might bring some of it to Sydney for my show.
Well, yes, indeed. And we should tell people about this show because it is starting on Wednesday the 15th of December at the Enmore Theatre, 5th of December at the Enmore Theatre. The tickets are already on sale. And you've been to Australia a number of times before, Michael. Anything that you're planning to see in Sydney when you come back, apart from a full house at the Enmore on the 5th of December?
Yeah, a full house, that's what I'm really coming to see.
Yes.
I did a tour about 3 years ago. I love being on stage in Australia. You get great reaction from the audience. I'm not going to have much time to walk around Sydney, though I certainly shall try and get down. The Harbour Bridge is just one of the great, great constructions of the world. I have a thing about it.
Have you climbed it, Michael?
I should walk under it.
You can walk over it as well, you know.
I know. I did once, yeah.
Did you?
I did it. I've done the walk right at the top. Yeah, yeah.
Beautiful. All right, Michael.
So I've lived.
Oh, you certainly have, more than most.
I've been everywhere, man. Well, we're looking very much forward to you coming, Michael, and all the best, and thanks for speaking with us this morning.
Lovely. Really nice to talk to you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay. Bye now.
There we go. Michael Palin. Isn't he lovely?
Isn't it nice just to be able to pick up the phone and there's Michael Palin on the other end?
Not too bad, this job of ours. It's not too shabby, is it, at all?
No, it's not too shabby.
Let me give you the details again. Wednesday, the 5th of December at the Enmore Theatre, and tickets are already on sale for that two-part program about HMS Erebus.
Mossman.
Rosebery.
Camperdown.
Botany.
Blacktown.
Kings Langley.
Kaimia Bay.
Cronulla.
On ABC Radio Sydney, this is Breakfast with Robbie Buck and Wendy Harmer.